You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. This is episode 296 of the Columbia Calling podcast, and this week's very special guest will be Stephen Grattan, who is a foreign correspondent from Ireland, who's been here for 6 years, and of course he's been reporting on everything you can possibly imagine, from LGBT rights to the issues in Venezuela, what's going on before the elections on this coming 27th of October. In fact, he's done a great deal in the 6 short years that he's been here, and I'm sure that all of you at some point or another have heard his voice on the radio or seen his face on the TV or definitely read one of his articles, because he's a prolific freelancer, and you know, we need to support our freelancers because they're the ones who really get out there and tell the stories, getting out on a limb to tell the stories, you know, with no insurance behind them, with no real backing behind them. These are the guys telling the news on the ground from the locations that need to be reported about. But huge news. I mean, if for those of you who don't follow my Instagram or Twitter or Facebook feeds, you wouldn't have known, but we were nominated. The Columbia Calling podcast was nominated in several categories by the Latin Podcast Awards, and we won. This year we won Best English Language Podcast from Latin America. So pretty phenomenal. I'm very thrilled to have won an award. It's people have said it's a long time coming, but I don't think so. I just feel I'm very honored to have been alongside such amazing outlets. When you see the list of people who are put forward for these awards, it's a real honor to be even named in the same breath and on the same page. So Columbia Calling 2019 Latin Podcast English Language Podcast of the Year winner. That's a real honor for me, and of course for the show, and it's all for you guys. You keep on listening week in, week out, because without you there'd be no show. It'd just be a crazy man like me talking out over the airwaves. Well, I'm going to leave you in the capable hands now of Adrian Alsimer, who's going to give you the news updates out of Medellin. Of course, Columbia Reports, he's the director of it. Throw some money at it on their Patreon site, or just check out the site and see what you might like there. www.columbiareports.com. And so don't go away. We'll be back in segment three with Stephen Grattan telling us some anecdotes and stories about his time here in Colombia, and of course some of the stories that he's reported on and some of the experiences that he wants to share with us. So thank you again, and don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsimer, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for October 22, 2019. The trial against former President Álvaro Uribe is causing tensions between the US government and Colombia's Supreme Court, according to Weekly Semana. The US Department of Justice has refused to surrender prison records that sought to establish if Uribe's fixer visited extradited paramilitaries. This is the second time this year that the Trump administration refuses to cooperate with Colombian justice. The DOJ also refused to surrender evidence to support an unsubstantiated drug trafficking charge against a former FARC leader. A possible conviction would be bad press for the White House, because it would make Uribe the first convict with a Medal of Freedom he was given by former President George W. Bush. The government of President Ivan Duque is again in crisis after the Constitutional Court sank its 2018 budget finance plan. The decision is not retroactive, meaning that the government does not have to refund taxes or revoke tax breaks. Finance Minister Alberto Carrasquilla was given less than 2 months to again push his budget finance plans through Congress. If he fails, the government's budget will be without financing, with unforeseen consequences. Campaigning ahead of local elections were ended on Sunday, 1 week before Colombians take to the poll. Coming Sunday, the country will elect mayors, governors, city council members and deputies after one of the most violent elections in the past decade. In Bogotá, the races remained largely clean, but in cities like Cali and Medellín, the campaigns were marred by smear campaigns and other dirty election tactics. A Chinese company will be building the first metro system in the capital Bogotá, President Iván Duque announced. Colombia's capital has been promised a metro since 1942, but none of those attempts ever succeeded. This time it's not just talking, said Duque. The construction of the metro is expected to cost approximately $4.3 billion. The fixer of former President Álvaro Uribe is trying to prevent an arrest warrant against him. Self-proclaimed gangster attorney Diego Cadena claimed that a witness who confirmed to be bribed was trying to extort him. Evidence indicates Cadena paid former paramilitary Victor to confirm Uribe's claim he is the victim of a conspiracy. The BBC said human rights defender Francia Márquez is one of the world's 100 most influential and inspiring women. The British public broadcaster praised the black rights and environmental activist as a formidable leader. Márquez is a major critic of the government and survived an assassination attempt earlier this year. A radio host from the southwestern Nariño province was assassinated over the weekend. The journalist from the troubled port city of Tumaco is the fourth to be murdered this year. Press Freedom Foundation FLIP and the European Union condemned the murder and called on authorities to investigate. The prosecution has been able to determine a suspect in any of the previous three murders. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
This is episode 296 of the Colombia Calling podcast, segment 3. You've just heard from Adrian Alsamer giving you the updates from Colombia Reports and from his base there in Medellin. And my very special guest, as I mentioned in segment 1, is Stephen Grattan. He's from Northern Ireland, and I can't pronounce where he's from. He'll tell you in a second, but he's an accomplished foreign correspondent for the international press here in Colombia. If you've been following Colombia in any shape or form in the last few years, Stephen has been definitely in your, he's been on your reading list because he's in The Guardian. I've seen him in Era News. I've seen you. But Stephen, best that you introduce yourself and say where you've written. So welcome on Colombia Calling. That's all right. That's the idea. Flattery.
Thanks for having me. So yeah, I've been here for 6 years now. Uh-huh. I came mainly to try and get into journalism after finishing a journalism and Spanish degree.
Wow, okay.
In England. And yeah, I wanted to put into practice. So that's how I ended up here. And since that, things just kind of unfolded. I was only planning on being here for a year. I think 6 years, so that's quite unbelievable.
That's cool, though. I mean, that's a testament to how successful you're being and how awesome Colombia is.
Well, yeah, there's not. I mean, you definitely don't run out of things to write about here. So there's always stuff going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, after that first year, I started the Bogota Post newspaper, the English language, one of the English language newspapers here in Bogota, and after that, I went into academia for a while at the University of Rosario University, teaching journalism. But then, about a year and a half ago, I decided to fully concentrate on the freelancing and doing what I really wanted to be doing and writing for bigger international media outlets. So yeah, ever since a year and a half ago, that's what I've been doing. Stringing for Reuters, Guardian, Al Jazeera a lot recently.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I've seen you as well.
And as you said, yeah, the new humanitarian era and lots of different ones. A couple of things in Vice and stuff as well.
And Vice as well. Okay, cool. But talk about this. You know, you chose Colombia to come after your degree. So you're a young man. You chose Colombia, and you choose it because
I suppose you think that, you know, well, you know, there's a huge opportunity because of, you know, there's a news agenda here. Is it something worth
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, I was looking for a specific place to go where I could put, you know, a degree in journalism and Spanish specifically into play. I'd always been fascinated with Colombia as well, coming from Northern Ireland, you know.
Yeah.
But, we share quite similar histories in terms of conflict and whatnot. And yeah, there was around the time I came, well, it's 2013, there was no kind of whispers of peace then. It was still pretty much in action. But it turned out then to be kind of a good place to be because of those whispers of peace that happened, you know, 2014-15.
Right place, right time.
Exactly.
Very cool. That should be so fortuitous. And then, so you do this and you fall into it. And then, I mean, you, I guess, and it's Emma Newbury got together. You met over.
We met at a Guy Fawkes night party.
Of course,
of everything.
You do. Of course, you do.
At somebody's house, from the British Council. So we met there with another girl, Charlotte, who now works for Bloomberg in London. She is the pound correspondent, so she's got
the pound.
That's
quite
Brexit busy. And stuff. She's got a lot of stuff in her hands. So the three of us set that up.
Bogota Post.
Yeah, so we started that together. It was an idea. We've been working on it for a few months, and then it was around the time that Martin McGuinness, the ex-IRA boss turned politician. Was in Colombia because President Santos had
Did you do the piece on him then?
I did.
Yeah, I read that.
That was our first edition. So we rushed like crazy, crazy people to get that out. I don't think I slept literally for about 3 days. we went to, I had to find a printer. running around Bogota like a madman trying to. Yeah.
But anything can be done in Bogota. I mean, you find the printing press district, you can find the guillotine district, the district that sells only a certain type of screw. I mean, you know, and they go out to Caracas in that heartbreaking area, which is the pet shop district. I mean, so as soon as you know where you're headed, you'll find but the Bogota Post now, I mean, that we're talking 2013-14 when
that
you started?
That was 2014, the beginning 2014. Of 2014.
We're now 2019, it's going strong.
Yeah, it's still good.
Yeah, nice.
Emma's doing a very good job keeping it alive.
And if I ever get the unusual times when I get invited to something, I see her there.
Yeah.
I mean, she's there waving a flag, you know. It's always nice to know.
It's like independent media things like that are extremely difficult, so big hands up to you for keeping it going. And
definitely. What, are you still part of it, or have you completely separated yourself?
No, I completely separated from it to go into academia, because it was just too much all at the same time. But Emma and I were still very good friends.
Yeah. And when you were in academia, I know you part wrote a book.
Yeah, that's right. We did a book on, it's an academic book, but it was about the history of war correspondence. Reporting the wars, so it kind of has it goes from like the ancient times of war correspondence to the more modern times, and I did a chapter as well with one of my colleagues at the university, which looks at, it was about local journalists, comparing local journalists in Northern Ireland and Colombia and how they report on conflict. So we did like
that's fascinating because, of course, you don't think of the correspondence, you think of the peace accords and the technicalities of what's done between the let's say the opposing parties, but not the way that the correspondence writes.
It's hard to write when your own country.
Absolutely.
Wins up, you know, there's all these political divisions and things like that. So that was one of the main things we found in that.
And now you've stepped away from that.
Yeah. It's maybe something I'd like to go into when I'm a little bit older, maybe. Because it's quite slow paced.
Yeah, I can understand that.
And I wanted to be out there doing the journalism, not teaching it.
Yeah, and I can fully understand that as well. So, you know, let's move into the journalism, because that's really, you know, that's the most, for me, I call myself a journalist, but I've been moving away from it for the last few years. Mm-hmm. Not through a desire to move away from it, but a desire for economic stability and a little bit more responsibility to my family. I can't be in Kakata again, you know, in places like that, which I love. I love these things. And I've been described as a non-conventional adrenaline junkie for doing these sort of things. But, you know, that you come to a time where I guess, I don't want to say grow up, you just sort of grow out of it, I think. And I don't have the, I really don't have the desire to be in a competition pitching and so on and trying to convince editors. I just, you're a young man.
Especially as a freelancer as well. It's very difficult.
And it's, you know, how many refusals, rejections and stuff. And you're like, this is important. but anyway, and you must get in this issue as well. 6 years here and you're calling up a place and saying, well, this is important. And like, yeah, I don't think it's for our readers.
Yeah, I do a lot of... I actually have gotten good at arguing with editors, and I think they appreciate it. And I didn't use it in the beginning, but now that I've gotten a bit more confident, I feel like, you know, because these people, you know, you're talking to people in Washington, London, wherever, just sitting behind their desks, they're covering all over the world, they don't know what's a big story, what's important. You have to really make them understand.
There you go.
Like that last piece I did in Caucasia, which is in, you know, one of the pretty... hot areas of Colombia, would say. It was infamously quite a dangerous place during the armed conflict, and even still now, it's still very much gang controlled and whatnot.
Was that in Al Jazeera you wrote the
article? Al Jazeera.
And you were talking to the local a candidate or a mayor who had, you know, his door had been shot at.
He was a local councillor. And he was running for re-election, and he was kind of speaking out a little bit about, you know, the lack of the implementation of the peace process. I'm talking about things like cocoa production and education and opportunities for young people. And the gangs who were involved in these, you know, in the production of cocoa were not happy about this. And allegedly, that's who he thinks it was that attacked him. Because it was a rally the day before that he'd been saying these things. And then that's... evening at 1:30 in the morning, they shot 9 bullets through the front of his house.
I can't even imagine, you know, having your door shot at as a warning, you know.
And he's been, after that, he spent weeks trying to get, you know, the security, the government protection unit. They offer security to political candidates and to no avail at all. But he does not after about 5 weeks, and 7 people are now murdered in the local elections. I think it took a while for the government to actually get their act together.
Well, I mean, it's Caucasia. It's northern Antioquia in that border area as you get up to Cordoba, and it's that. I keep looking. I've just scribbled it down. It makes up part of that corridor that the ELN are trying to cement from the Pacific coast to Venezuela. You know, Caucasia sits in the middle, that kind of thing. And then you go up through the rivers, or through Nechi and Achi, where there's gold mining. And it's right there in this strategic point. And it's not a very scenic place. It's kind of just it almost feels like a rest stop on the Pan-American Highway.
But it's,
you know, pivotal.
A lot of the places where generally I do travel are not. Don't tend to be the pretty parts of Colombia.
Well, this is it. You're going there, but you're taking names. You know, it's like you can go to these. Especially
the place I was telling you about before we started, which is Maikao.
Tell us
that
about Maikao.
My least favorite place. I've been there 4 times in the last year, because that is, in terms of the Venezuelan migration story, a big place to be. Because that's where they opened the big UN camp, the first camp of its kind in Colombia.
How many people
are
in that
just,
camp?
In the camp?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, it's like a... It's not like one of these camps where people stay permanently. They only have a month max to be there. So it's just kind of like a place for migrants to have a bit of a rest off the street. Because most of these people in Mecca are living on the streets. It's just like it's pretty harsh scenes when you go there. And Maikao is definitely one of my least favorite places to go, but it's also the place where a lot of stories are. It just feels unsafe when you're there, especially when you're going as a freelancer. You don't have anyone else with you a lot of the time. It's like a big, dusty commercial. There's a lot of contraband happening there with the petrol and stuff. That's another big problem. And that has gotten more serious as well over the last couple of years since the Venezuelan migration, the Venezuelan crisis began.
There's a huge mosque in Macau, and it's linked to the Hezbollah attack on Buenos Aires all that time
back. Yeah, they say that. Exactly. Yeah. It's one of the third biggest mosques in Latin America. Yeah.
On this.
And there is a huge Muslim population, from Syria and Lebanon, I think. Yeah,
so as a freelancer, you have no, let's say, attachment to insurance that let's say, full-time journalists, correspondents get. You don't have any security.
No, not at all. I did one of these HEFAT courses, these hostile environment training courses once and that was funded by, James Foley's mother, the journalist who was beheaded by ISIS, because these cost like thousands of dollars to do. And
was it done here in Colombia? Like,
no, they sent me to Harrisonburg in Virginia.
Virginia?
Yeah.
Now, James, one of his best friends lives here in Colombia.
Oh.
And grew up with him, in fact.
Really?
And he was one of the first 10 episodes of this. But yeah, he was really, they grew up together. They were childhood friends, yeah.
He lives in Bogota?
No, he actually lives in La Vega now.
Okay.
So just outside of Bogota.
Not too far away.
Yeah, he just decided that the cold was no longer for him.
Which, interesting.
Yeah, but that must be a fascinating course to have.
It is. You get kidnapped. You get, shouted at. You get shot at. Well, obviously not really shot.
Sounds like
it's like, and it's ex British military guys that used to run them. And they're pretty intense. And they do all these kind of scenarios and role plays. We were, for example, hijacked at a checkpoint. Yeah, we were blindfolded and all these kind of things, and try and mentally prepare you for these things that could actually happen, and especially in somewhere like Colombia where things
have happened.
Really, as a foreign correspondent,
yeah.
You're probably most susceptible to being kidnapped in Colombia.
Do you? I mean, were there people on the course who actually like were broken? I mean, collapsed, started crying.
Mine was a 3-day one, and there's some for like Reuters, for example, they do these 5-day ones, which actually take place in my country, in Northern Ireland, and it's ex-RUC, ex-police, during the Troubles, who take these things.
That would terrify me.
And apparently they are really serious ones, and you don't get to sleep or anything. Those ones are like the real 5-day intense ones, and they sound petrifying. And I've heard of one in Mexico they do as well. Someone told me about that. A lot of people broke down on that one because there was like fake rape things or this kind of stuff. It sounded absolutely atrocious. Like it sounded a little bit too much.
Someone died on one here. But like a state worker. I think something about
because a lot of the people who work in oil and gas and stuff
had a heart attack because they got so worked up about it. Bags on their heads and they were being kicked and whatever. Uh-huh. I mean, it's like, up until these horrible stories, it just sounded like boarding school. But then, get kidnapped and they try and break your spirit, lack of sleep. Yeah, but but how good to have been on that, because it obviously makes you more aware
and it gives you a little bit more. Yeah, definitely. That makes you a little bit more confident as well, I think.
But, I mean, in Macau, for example, you said you've been there 3 times this year. You have a safe place to stay. They know you. They look after you.
The best hotel in town, which is not really...
Yeah, it's
a great hotel.
They have a gate. on the door? No.
It's very basic. Everything there is very basic.
God,
but they have great Arabic food, as you mentioned, because of the... I lived off Arabic food for any.
This is not a bad thing. This is one of the upsides.
That's the only upside.
This dusty, dangerous, aggressive town. You were also there at on the Cúcuta border when the concert was on, Branson concert.
It was.
Yeah, how was that concert?
Oh, it was just ridiculous.
Yeah, it looked like it. I watched a bit of it. I watched a bit.
I was covering for Reuters then. And it was so stressful because of the amount of people who were attending the event. There was no phone signal. So I had my boss, we need this, we need a quote, we need stuff. So I wasn't able to get any information out. Meanwhile, my other colleague who was also covering it was on the other border while the, the kind of confrontation was kicking off. Yeah, that was an interesting trip. Yeah.
But you don't, you've not been stuck in the tear gas? And...
No.
Yeah.
I was actually that on that trip. That was more my colleague.
Yeah.
He was on that side of things.
Well, I've got lined
up
for
on
next
the
next one, I think.
On the barricaded bridge, waiting for the president to come out and say something.
A Duque or Guaido?
Both.
Both.
They were both there in negotiations. And I was there literally for 8 hours sitting with all this.
But they came out, right?
So it was good that there was Reuters had various... You know, if you're a freelancer, you just have to be in one, one or the other.
Yeah.
Some people chose to go to the action. Some people chose to wait for the...
And this is when Guaido walked out and went, this is my bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was just ridiculous. It was the whole spectacle. The whole thing was just completely...
His star has waned, hasn't it?
Since that thing with him being photographed, I suppose.
That's
what you trigger it.
The Rastrojos.
Yeah.
They had to know. They had to know. I mean, who are the people who control the coming and going of contraband along the border? I mean, it's and also you think the opportunity for Guaido was months back.
And on reporting trips recently to these places like Macau and places on the border, I have asked people their thoughts on him now, and it definitely is winding. I think it was this one moment, this explosion of hope.
It was that moment,
and
wasn't
then it just dwindled away after that, when the aid didn't get in.
That's right, when it didn't work. And then that, was it the Molotov that was actually thrown from the Colombian side that then ended up sort of burning a truck, and it was then blamed on the Venezuelan.
Yeah.
Great reporting by the New York Times on that part. That was excellent. Did you do a piece, or did you see the soldiers who deserted from the Venezuelan
army? Yes, I was.
Because they're in all sorts of trouble now.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's, I knew that Dylan.
Yeah.
I know it's coming on your show soon. Did a big piece about that. And I also did a piece for Al Jazeera. But that was also quite strange. It was hard to know whether these guys were being really sincere or not. Whether they were just chanting their arm. Yeah.
And now they're in this political limbo.
Yeah.
And no one's paying the hotel where they're staying. And they were promised everything. And, well, that happens so often. Something's come up in this conversation, and I know my listeners are loving it because they absolutely love these episodes which are based around sort of foreign correspondence and kind of adventures, danger, of course. And you wrote this book on war correspondence in the chapter and so on. Do you think of yourself as a war correspondent or just
I think. Maybe if I had been here more back in the day, I think that would be a more appropriate title.
Because I would, if someone said to me, I'd say, that's a conflict.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a nice romantic title to have, and it's definitely something that I was always wanting to do at university, and it was the kind of journalism I was interested in, but I wouldn't consider the work that I do covering migration and stuff, even though some of the places I go to are pretty sketchy, I still wouldn't consider myself a war correspondent per se. I think I would have to be somewhere in like Syria and Turkey, on the Turkish border, where there's actual ammunition being fired at me to be considered that.
It was truly horrific.
Because I remember when I was in, I met Orla Gurin, Irish journalist.
Really?
She's one of my favorites. And when I was in Cúcuta at that concert that you mentioned just earlier there. And we talked about it, and she said that she doesn't consider herself to be a war correspondent either, because she looks for the more human side of the stories that are happening in countries where conflict's taking place. So I think being a war correspondent, you actually have to be on the front line and have ammunition fired at you.
Okay.
That's my kind of definition.
You've not had that yet, and let's hope that doesn't happen.
You never know. Maybe
it might have happened.
We'll see how adventurous I get over the next few years or so.
But maybe you're a humanitarian, correspondent then.
I did a master's recently in human rights because I wanted to kind of start doing more of those kind of stories. I do a lot of LGBT stories as well, related to Venezuelan migration. And I've worked on the issue of sex work as well because of Venezuelan migration. And just general social empowerment. So I've done a lot of things from Choco and Quito.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm getting jealous, and they're important as well. Yeah.
Do you go down?
But they're the stories that are harder to also hard to sell sometimes.
Yes.
Because they're not as newsy, they're not as strong, but they're important.
They're important.
The positive pieces in that.
Do you go down into like then Santa Fe and Los Martires and Bogota?
That was my first big piece when I started out about a year and a half ago. Was for the Guardian.
Bill Gates. Was it the Bill and Melinda Gates piece?
Yes.
One of those pieces.
Google development.
Yeah, I read everything.
Yeah, you did. You're up to date. No, it was about the sex workers there, the trans sex workers who had started a mural newspaper. God, I can't say that word in accent. A mural newspaper.
A mural newspaper.
A mural.
Okay.
And they stuck that to the walls of the streets where the women were sex working so that they could, and they produced this like monthly for a while. I think it stopped now. And it was so that people who were working in the streets could kind of inform themselves a bit of news and things that were happening in the neighborhood.
That's pretty cool.
That was called La Esquina, the corner. So it was kind of, it was a quirky little piece and no one had picked up on it before. It did very well, and Colombian media also picked up on it a lot. Semana had the same story.
They didn't
rewritten a week after.
But they didn't put your name and just translate it badly.
No, they didn't. They actually sent a reporter.
Okay.
So.
Because that's got me in trouble years and years ago. So they just took a piece that I wrote for the BBC and translated it badly.
Mm.
And I started getting cold calls from Colombian generals. That's not always the fun. Accusing me of being a guerrilla sympathizer and stuff.
I had that for one of the last piece. God, anytime you do anything about the FARC, it's just ridiculous here.
No, yeah.
Especially if you're on Twitter.
No, yeah.
The last piece did for Reuters, which was about the... it was a big piece I did for them. It did quite well. It was about the killing, well, the threats and the killings of the former combatants.
Yeah, 178?
Something like that. Yeah. It keeps going up and down. So I went to, this was just before the dissidents announced that they were rearming. What was the point of that?
Well, your FARC sympathizer.
Oh yeah, on Twitter. God, I get Twitter bashed by.
Oh yeah.
You know.
I have a few trolls.
Anyone I get. Yeah, trolls. I get messages telling me I should. Back off to my own country.
Oh, they always say that, and you're like, "What? Why?"
This wasn't objective reporting, even though I had many voices in there from the government as well and whatnot.
But
yeah, it was. It's always very difficult to report in those things, even now.
And he's equally so Twitter. I mean. Come on.
Yeah.
It's like,
keyboard warriors.
Yeah, it's like, thank you for replying from where you are in Miami, having left before you were, put up for conscription.
Yeah, exactly.
This sort of thing. I used to engage, now I don't engage.
Yeah, I try not to because it's...
But sometimes it riles you up. I mean,
yeah, that's what I recommend that looking unprofessional.
If I've got insomnia... Then that's my thing. But Reuters, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, New Humanitarian, Vice. I mean, this is a really impressive resume. And so, what's next? I mean, what have you got? What are you pitching in the next couple of weeks?
I'm actually starting to look for other opportunities outside of Colombia.
Oh no way!
I'm quite interested in Mexico.
Well, it's pretty interesting.
I think 6 years has been quite a long time here. You know, I know the country pretty well. It feels like it's time for maybe a little change. But I want to stay in the region, not America.
Okay.
So I'm looking at other possibilities. But I will still be pitching stories. I've got... I want to go back to Cúcuta because it's been a while since I've been there. Have a little look around, see if I can find anything there.
You're the first person I've ever heard to say that.
I want to go back
to Cúcuta.
Well, I think, I think it'd be interesting. Well, after that humanitarian aid story, after the concert, Al Jazeera kept me in there for 20 days because they thought something big was going to happen. So they employed me for 20 days to stay there. Oh, and it was...
That's a long 20 days.
But it was interesting because when you're not focusing on that one story, when you actually go out and talk to people around other smaller places, and you find things that haven't been done before, and important stories.
That's cool.
I like to go back and revisit places, and
definitely
find different angles.
It's important to go back and revisit a story to see that development. Again, hard to sell, but at the same time, you know, we were here half a year ago when it was the great hope of Guaido and all of this thing, and now, how many people have crossed the border, how many more are living in the streets, mm-hmm. and especially leading into the elections on the 27th. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so nobody, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't seen any real candidates talking about migration issues. I haven't seen Venezuela question coming into it. They're all mm-hmm. deliberately avoiding it because it's a hot potato.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
a... But I do have some ideas in mind, but
yeah.
I'm not going to tell you.
That's fine. You can come back on later, you know, after your Pulitzer,
yes.
and tell me. But you will go to Mexico, because you've got it in your mind, because you set it out. And Mexico is a phenomenal country, which I love.
Well, it's very interesting at the minute with the whole border issue and the Trump's re-election campaign. So
yeah,
it does. I think it could be a good place.
But it will also connect you back to Colombia, of course, with the cartels here. The Nuevo Jalisco and the Sinaloa cartels,
mm-hmm.
found in Cauca to this day. I mean,
it's pretty crazy.
Stuff. It's pretty crazy. So you'll end up being that link between the two countries, the guy who knows. There you go. So it's all about being in the right place at the right time.
Indeed. Yeah.
So you're going to be embedding yourself in Tijuana or in Juarez.
Yeah. Really don't know yet. This is early days, but it's a little idea.
But you've been talking to your editors, perhaps saying, "I'm thinking of going." And
I've mentioned a few. Yeah.
Okay, cool. There you go. Well, hopefully, I mean, it's been about 3 years that we've been trying to meet one another, but hopefully we'll be able to, you know, cross paths before you go or talk.
Or maybe I'll end up here for another 6 years.
Yeah.
I've been saying for years I'm going to leave and never have, so.
Well, you know, I'm 13 years now and kids, there's just no way I'm going anywhere. But I do love it. And like I say, every week, it's peaks and troughs. There are great days and there are bad days, and that's normal. And there are in-between days. But there would be in England, and there would be in France, and there would be in Canada, and there would be in Mexico, and there would be anywhere else you could be. You know, it's the truth. But what, I mean, as we wind this down, you're humanitarian correspondent, but you are going to some pretty dodgy places, Caucasia, Maikau, Cúcuta, well, places that are considered dodgy, but you know your way around and so on. You know, your family back home, I mean, what do they say? Or it's like, I know that Stephen, he's always been crazy.
You know, I think my mum sees, she's very active on social media since I've been away. So she likes to look at what I'm doing, and you know, it's quite funny now because I remember before I left Colombia, she hardly knew how to switch on her computer. And now she is using Snapchat and all these things I don't even know.
But this is not for like 14-year-olds.
Well, she loves it. She works with young people in her job, so I think that she gets taught these things. And I think she does worry, but
of course she does.
They never ask too many questions in detail about it. I don't tell them any of the dodgy details. I mean, Caucasia, you know, I'm sure if she Googled it, she would figure out that it was dodgy enough. But
then, I mean, she has to know. She has to say, you're not.
But you know, I take measures before going to these places. I speak to the right people. I ask questions. You know, it's really important to assess the risks before just diving in. You know, I know some foreign correspondents who come here and they just do crazy stuff, and it's like, you know, now those risks are...
Well, that's the thing, is when you get...
Especially when you're younger, you don't think about it as much, you know?
The sort of fireman journalists that dropped in. Well, that's how, you know...
Swashbuckling, like, you know...
Well, how Vice started as well, just dropping their kids in.
And it's...
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of that as well, because I mean, you know, the reporting might be great and they might be able to do the things, but also there needs to be a bit of a background. There needs to be an understanding of where things come from, especially in somewhere as complex as Colombia.
Extremely complex, exactly.
That's really
one of the things I think younger freelancers struggle with when they first come here, especially if you're covering politics and things like that, or anything about. Even I do so still.
Yeah, well,
like covering that Uribe story last week, when he was on trial, I wrote a piece about that. There's just so much context that you have to try and get into these pieces. And
it dates back. I mean, we're looking at 2014, 2012 conversations. I mean, not even sort of like, it was almost anecdotal up to a point. You're like, so where exactly? And it was behind closed doors. So how much do we really know about it? I don't know how you wrote a piece about it.
It was kind of a curtain raiser for Al Jazeera. It was kind of like, what to expect.
What to, they have bullet points and stuff. Okay, good. Yeah, but it's that kind of thing. And of course, everyone was expecting sort of marches and protests that day, and it was a bit of a damp squib. It's like, well, Paloma Valencia and 20 other cats in the Parque Nacional. Okay, well, very good. So, I mean, you've traveled around, which I like because it gives you a real feeling for the country. And how do you see things, let's say, developing in Colombia? Let's just say in the immediate future, if we're looking at the next 6 months, we've got elections on the 27th of October. Duque has an incredibly weak mandate. He's got a minority in Congress. This next 6 months for the presidency do you have any opinions on this? Well, you might.
I feel like we're kind of leading up to some sort of big explosion.
There is some
globally.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But also in Colombia, I think we're leading up to an explosion again of something. I'm not going to say violence, but it is highly possible.
There's something here, isn't there? There's a simmering.
Exactly. That's what people keep saying. It's kind of simmering away. And it is worrying. I speak to people and people are worried. When you go to the region, when you go to the more rural areas, people are all saying, the peace isn't here. None of the stuff that has been promised is getting here. And you kind of think to yourself, how is this happening? A country that's had 52 years, whatever it is, of armed conflict, how is the government not taking this seriously enough to try and make it not come back, not return?
And coming from Northern Ireland, with the knowledge of this, what concerns me the most is the sort of duplicitous nature of the politics, where you get Duque talking about how much has been achieved overseas, and then here strangling in the process, starving.
And the Venezuelan migration has kind of disguised a lot of the mediocreness of his presidency today.
Well, that's it. It's an easy thing. And what we're looking at this week as well is this perpetual, what they call it, the cadena perpetua for people who rape children. Mm-hmm. I don't think that even needs to go to, like a consultation. I think we all believe that. Right. And it's just rhetoric to steer us away from the real stories, I fear. Well, I don't know. I mean, we get into a negative point there, but it's really been fascinating and a very, it's very positive. You came out here on a whim and really, Reuters, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, New Humanitarian, Vice, these are not small publications. And again, I thank you for putting me in touch with, I think it was the BBC 7 weeks ago about Egan Bernal. I think it was. I am appreciative of any work thrown my way. I'm still a freelancer at heart, despite a desk job. But more about that at another time. Thank you for taking the time to come out here and chat to us and tell us about these are achievements. These are achievements, and you should be proud of yourself, and your mother should not be worried, because I'm hoping she's going to tune in.
Hi, Mom.
I'm hoping she's going to tune in and say, that's my Stephen there. And so thank you again. And should you go to Mexico, I wish you all the best in Mexico. And because you want to go, let it not be another 6 years before you leave for Mexico. It's been a real pleasure. Where can we see? Do you have a website or social media?
Steve S. J. Grattan is my Twitter, and my website is StephenGrattan.com.
Stephen Grattan.
GRATTAN.
Perfect. So check that out, StephenGrattan.com. I'll put it on, of course, on the Facebook page, and SJ Grattan on Twitter, but you're not allowed to troll him. That's it. That's we've said it here. You're not allowed to troll him. Anyway, so we've been talking to foreign correspondent and, let's say, humanitarian reporter Stephen Grattan here on the Colombia Calling podcast, episode 296. It's been a really interesting and in-depth episode about what it means to be a correspondent here in Colombia. And, you know, one guy's success story over this period of years, it doesn't, you know, it's not for the faint of heart to come out here, you know, on a wing and a prayer and then make it happen. And, you know, some of it's, of course, right moment, right time, right moment, but the rest of it is just, you know, hoofing it. And getting out there and putting yourself in front of editors and in their face and arguing, as he said. And you know, this is a good story. So thank you for coming on the show. And thank you that we finally met after about 3 years.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
It's been fun. It's been a great episode. I know you guys out there have enjoyed it. Please tune in next week. I hopefully have another correspondent lined up because we're going through some you know, let's say analyst and correspondent phase, my interests, but I hope you're interested too. Anyway, that's me, Richard McCall, signing off for Colombia Calling, episode 296 this week. Thank you again. Spread the word and be sure to tune in next week. Bye-bye.